We're going to do, David Laird, why don't you come up and introduce your students that you brought, and we'll get going. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Laird.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's always a pleasure to see you.
Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is David Laird. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. We're delighted that you want to hear from us today, and we appreciate the time that you allocated to us. We have two students, Jessica and Vince, who will introduce themselves in more detail as they speak, and two presidents, president from McAllister and the president from St. Catharines, to speak to you. All of us are here to respond to the basic question that you have posed to us. How is the current financial crisis or transition, whatever language you're comfortable with, affecting your institution and the students and families that we serve? We hope that you will have some questions of these folks. They are literally on the firing line and among the affected. And we hope that later on in the session there will be an opportunity for us to come back and talk with you in more detail about the impact of financial aid on not only our students, but all students here in the state. The president, as they speak to you about the financial impact, will also speak to you about the effect that financial aid has on the students that they serve from Minnesota. So we're very appreciative with that, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to take any more time. I think it's important that you hear from the people that we've assembled for you. And as I understand it, Vince is going to start out today with you, and he and Jessica will introduce themselves as they speak.
Vince, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Vince Fuller. I'm from the University of St. Thomas. Good afternoon, and I thank everybody for letting me speak here today. And I want to also thank you for the work that you've done in helping make college affordable and accessible to me and other low-income students. Excuse me. I want to talk to you a little bit about where I come from, why I decided to go to the University of St. Thomas, and what I'm doing there and what I'm going to do after I graduate. A little more about me. My family life, I was born and raised in Annandale, Minnesota. I come from a divorced family. My parents were divorced when I was 5 years old. I have two younger brothers, one of which is currently a sophomore in college. As you know, coming from a divorced family, financing problems can be difficult for being from a divorced family. Also, last year my dad passed away on October 4th. 2007, actually, at the age of 45 from a sudden heart attack. That also has put a humongous burden. Now, the funding that I was received from my parents for the college was essentially cut in half. The other hard part is my mom is a real estate agent, and with the current housing crisis and the economy, her income is fairly low. So why St. Thomas? Weighing college choices, out of high school, I decided to attend St. Thomas because I was interested in becoming a Catholic priest. I attended college seminary at the University of St. Thomas, which is called St. John Vianney College Seminary. I decided it wasn't what God wanted me to do with my life, and I left after my sophomore year of college, but I continued to stay at St. Thomas for 2 more years. I couldn't leave St. Thomas. I loved my professors and class sizes. I was able to get the one-on-one attention that I needed and establish the long-lasting businesses. St. Thomas was the right choice. Academic choices. I got to choose a major I wanted within business, which my major is entrepreneurship. The faculty support was amazing. All of my courses were taught by professors. And they also helped me support in starting my own business, which I am currently doing this spring. And I'm also another reason why St. Thomas was the right choice. I'm able to graduate in 4 years. I'll be graduating this May. And what has also, St. Thomas has also given me significant off-campus opportunities. I got an internship last summer at Target, which now has turned into a job position, and where I'll be working after I graduate in May. Talk a little bit about how St. Thomas, how I was able to go to St. Thomas through, talk about my funding. St. Thomas is about $35,434 a year for tuition and fees. My financial aid package for this year was $28,000. And I can go into kind of how that broke down. I ended up getting $4,200 from St. Thomas Scholarship. I also received $5,000 Monsignor Terrence Murphy Scholarship, which was a need-based scholarship that was given to me because of my family situation and my dad passing away a year and a half ago. I also received $1,981 in federal Pell Grant money. I also received $1,000 in federal Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant. I received $6,397 in Minnesota State Grant. And then I also have $5,500 for a federal subsidized loan, $2,000 for a federal unsubsidized loan, and I also took out an additional $2,000 loan from the next 6 months through one of their programs. Also, with these costs, I've also been able to save $8,000 this year alone on room and board. For the past 2 years, I've been a residence advisor at the University of St. Thomas, which has been a significant help for me also. Kind of give you some little other information on my current financial situation after college. I'll be graduating with around $24,000 in debt. And I've paid over $7,000 over the last 4 years out of pocket expenses. I've been able to do that through my various jobs throughout the summers. And then this last year, I've continued to work at Target after my internship this summer until I get my full-time position in the spring. Kind of other expenses has also increased the cost of tenants too, like health insurance at St. Thomas is $445 a semester. I was previously on my dad's health care plan after he passed away, that was not attainable. Then other parking expenses are also $450 a year. So obviously a lot of these things can add up. I talk about what's next after I graduate. I plan to begin a career with Target Corporation. I'll be working as an executive team leader at the store level. I'm also starting a family business this spring that sells Granite Memorial. My grandfather's been in the business for over 50 years. And those are kind of my plans after I graduate. And again, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to speak here today.
Thank you, Vince. And nice job, too, because you explained, I'm sure, some of the things that the committee would have. I was going to ask you about your debt and your funding and that. So thank you very much. Nice job. I may need one of those memorials by the end of the session. So how about a good deal on it, okay?
Absolutely.
Welcome to the committee. Let's see, Jessica, why don't you just go ahead and identify yourself for the tape. And
okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Jessica Brooks. I'm a senior history major at Carleton College. I am a Minnesota State Grant recipient as well, and I want to thank you for helping make my college affordable and accessible as a low-income student. I want to start off with telling you a little bit about where I'm from. I'm originally from Canton, Ohio. I was born and raised in Canton, Ohio, from a family that's considered below poverty, single-parent home. And the schools that I went to, the counselors would tell me that I didn't have to worry about college, that wasn't something that I should look forward to, that I should get a job after high school. a few opportunities for me to do anything outside of school. Most of my friends were in gangs and violence, preteen pregnancy, and things of that nature. When I was in eighth grade, I was at the top 10% of my class, and me and 20 students were introduced to a national program called A Better Chance. And out of the 20 students, four of us actually took the application and applied for ABC. And out of the four of us, two of us took the exam to get into national ABC, and I was the only student to actually go to my ABC school, which was Eden Prairie, Minnesota, A Better Chance program. So I left home when I was 14, moved to Minnesota, and moved into a house with 13 other girls from across the country so that I could have a better chance to go to college. The program is geared toward socially and economically disadvantaged students and socially and economically disadvantaged school systems. So what Eden Prairie did was give me the ability to look forward to college, which was something that my teachers in Canton, Ohio told me was not something that I could do. In my 4 years as an ABC scholar in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, I started looking for the best colleges that had fine arts and also sciences because I was sure that I was going to find a cure for cancer one day. Tarleton popped up as the number one private liberal arts college in the nation that had what I wanted, theater and also biochemistry. So I started looking forward to Tarleton. That was the only college I wanted to go to. It was smaller than Eden Prairie High School, and I needed it to be smaller than Eden Prairie High School. So with ABC, I did a lot of speaking engagements. We would go around and talk to different organizations like Optimist Club, the Rotary Club, and talk about what ABC was about and why they should support the program. And at each of those events, I would say that I didn't want to go anywhere but Carleton. And at each of those events, I'd meet a Carleton alum. And they'd ask me what I wanted, but they told me that to let them know what they could do to help me go to Carleton, and I'd say, write me a recommendation. And 13 recommendations later, I got a call from Carleton saying not to send anymore. but I got in. And I've been at Carleton for the past 4 years, and it was the right choice for me and the best choice for me. I figured out that biochemistry was not the route for me, and it was easy for me to go from being pre-med to being a history major, because what Carleton did as a liberal arts college, I had the opportunity to take classes outside of sciences and realize that I actually really loved history, and that was something that I wanted to pursue. During my time at Carleton, I also participated in off-campus studies programs. I went to Jamaica to study dance for a few weeks, which was basically a vacation. And then I also had internships.
You shouldn't tell us that, yeah.
You might want to find out.
And then I had corporate internships at Target, Target Corporation for 3 years, and then Cargill Incorporated this past summer. A few of the benefits of being at Carleton was the resident-focused atmosphere of Carleton. I don't think I would have been able to afford to live off-campus, but what it did was allow me to interact with people on a daily basis. Carleton is very residential. It also gave me faculty support that I don't think I would have found in other colleges. I've had faculty members come to my job at the coffee shop and tutor me for statistics. So it's been a really, really good experience. And just to tell you a little bit about, I guess, my financial aid package, Carleton, for a year at Carleton, tuition and fees adds up to $48,000. Out of that $48,000, Carleton scholarships covered $31,000. And private scholarships, $3,000. My federal Pell grant was $8,000. My Minnesota State grant was $4,000. I had a Perkins loan this year of only $1,200, and my work study covered $1,500. There's also TRIO SSS at Carleton, and the TRIO program at Carleton offers a book program where you just check out books every term. So I was fortunate that I didn't have to pay for books. My first experience going into the bookstore, before I figured out TRIO covered books, I almost cried because my entire savings was the amount of one book. So that was my book experience, was covered by that. I've also had to work off campus as well as on campus to take care of other things like food and just being able to be at Carleton. What I plan to do after Carleton, I have applied for programs like Admissions Possible and other nonprofit programs that help low-income students like me, programs that I was involved in when I was in high school that helped me with my college process. I wanted to thank you for having me here today and for listening to my story. And also I would like to say that without everything and all the programs that helped me, like A Better Chance, Admissions Possible, and my Minnesota State grant and other scholarships to help me pay for Carleton, I don't know where I would be, but if birds of a feather flock together, then I'd probably be in prison, or I'd have a child by now, or I'd be involved in gang violence and drugs. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jessica, and nice job. How much are you going to be in debt? I know you mentioned $1,200 in loans, but
well, I think
Jim told us that he's going to spend the next couple of years working on that.
I'm actually only going to be about $10,000 in debt, but when I graduate, I don't have a home and I don't have a savings or anything like that. So that's a whole other issue to tackle when I graduate.
And if you don't mind me asking, that, so you've been living in Carleton then for 4 years?
Yes.
Did you vote this time here?
Yes.
Did you vote for represented by? Because he's gonna, he asked, he raised his hand, so I don't know. Okay, Representative Bryce.
It doesn't matter whether you voted for me or not.
Okay.
It's great to have both of you here. And actually, I wanted to say that, you know, you, both of your stories in some way have connection with my own experience. I went to St. Olaf in Northfield, and actually my father died when he was 43, and so before I started college. And it was the generosity, really, of the college that helped me get through. Of course, it wasn't as expensive back then as it is now, and I'm glad to see that stories like both of your stories can still happen. But it is disturbing the amount of debt that you have acquired. Also, in Northfield, we had a chapter of ABC, A Better Chance,
yep.
Which was started after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I got to know many of the students who went through that program, and it was really an education for me to work shoulder to shoulder with them and trying to get my high school diploma. So, but you're a credit to that program and to the Carleton College as well. It's great that you got there, and I can tell from your story and the way that you've told it that you'll have a great future. So thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bly. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did I hear that you both had internships at Target?
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a job, Ms. Brooks?
No,
I do not. But your internship led to a job.
Yes, correct.
And is that guaranteed?
Yes. I was offered a position right after my internship ended in September. So kind of really before this all really hit, that was offered position. Store level jobs are different than, obviously you've heard in the news, the corporate jobs are different, they're kind of two different pyramids. And so having at the store level, a lot of times you, if they need reduced any numbers, executives get moved around, and you know, there's not really necessarily anybody that needs to be removed.
So you're going, Mr. Chair, you're going to be an executive at a store level?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So then the $1,000 person layoff didn't...
That did not.
Okay. Thank you.
We welcome any other questions to the committee. Well, thank you very much. Very informative. And with that, then, Sister Lee, you here?
Yes.
And why don't they both come, both of you come up,
thank you.
Dr. Rosenberg, too. Welcome both of you to the committee. And Sister Lee, if you want to start off, and just for your information, I was taught by nuns for 8 years, so look at how I turned out.
Look how great you turned out.
Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Thank you, and thank you for having us here today. As Representative said, my name is Andrea Lee, and I'm president of the College of St. Catherine, soon to be St. Catherine University. St. Kate's is the largest college for women in North America, We enroll over 5,000 students and graduate hundreds of students every year who work in Minnesota's healthcare, business, education, social service, and civic arenas. We are engaged in workforce development at every degree level, at the associate, baccalaureate, master's, and doctoral levels. We are a Minnesota institution and for all practical purposes prepare students to live and work in Minnesota. And we do so, as do all of Minnesota's private colleges, with very small but critical assistance from the state of Minnesota in the form of state grants, and in particular St. Catherine's Child Care Assistance Grants for our students. While I'm tempted to use these few minutes that I have in this bully pulpit to launch a compelling, if not airtight, argument in support of state-supported financial aid to students who choose a private college like St. Kate's, I want to share a bit of my own experience over nearly 30 years of managing institutional budgets, which, if they are unlike the states as to the number of zeros, are very much like them in that they are created to advance shared and meaningful purposes. They exist in a universe I know of many competing goods and sadly limited or diminishing resources. And they are human and therefore flawed products created with flawed processes and, of course, with inadequate time. That is not to say, however, that the allocation of resources cannot be a process that engages the best mind, imagination, and discipline of folks who ultimately share a common purpose, that is, the greatest good for the greatest number. Achieving this goal is an effort worth our very best efforts, and one in which, I believe, partisan entrenchment should have a receding, if any, role. I believe that I speak for every college, private college president in the state, and I'd even dare to say for President Brunix and Chancellor McCormick, in saying that we want to be your partners and your allies in solving this crisis and establishing a firm footing for the future. We have resources to share in terms of our faculty expertise and institutional nimbleness, especially in responding to critical workforce needs. In parallel fashion, we also need resources from you in order to make our most powerful and enduring contribution to the future strength of Minnesota. We need a small investment that will have a huge payoff. As a college president, I can say with the conviction that comes from 30 years in this business, here and in the core city of Detroit before, that there is no investment more important than education, especially during a period of economic turmoil. I say that because I have experienced its truth again and again over time. The return on investment for a state grant, which we just heard expressed so eloquently by our students, is a productive lifetime of engagement in the state's most critical workforce areas: healthcare, education, business, science, and technology, to just name a few. Stated another way, the return on investment is a predictable, decades-long stream of tax revenue that comes from employees engaged in critical workforce areas. As for my own institution and for others like it, we work mightily, often with very restricted resources, to educate students, and contrary to popular perception, not rich ones. At St. Kate's, the average student is not wealthy. She is far more likely the daughter of a farmer, of a Northwest airline mechanic, or a teacher. She may be a woman on public assistance or an immigrant. In fact, our entering freshman class this year included dozens of Hmong and Somali women. Our School of Health offers healthcare workforce preparation to more than 2,000 students annually, and a perception-shattering percentage of these students receive both Pell and state grants. Tens of thousands of students attend Minnesota's private colleges and universities. Most are not wealthy. The truth is that many private college students are parents and are full or part-time employees struggling to balance the demands of work, family, and school. The average family income of a St. Catherine freshman is surprisingly low, in the low $60,000 range, 25% less than a comparable average family income for a University of Minnesota freshman. Indeed, many students at private colleges come from low-income or working-class families, as we just heard. When considering the state grant program, I believe it is critical to resist the temptation to couch the discussion within the public-private debate, because it sets up a false either-or debate that hurts students and hurts the state of Minnesota. The bare truth is this: the 1,200 or so of St. Catherine students who get state grants are also eligible for Pell Grants. if they need a state grant to enroll at the College of St. Catharines, they need it to enroll anywhere. If a student needs a state grant to go to school, she needs it whether she attends St. Catharines or the university or a Minsky school. In addition, our nursing programs, for example, have a wait list out past 2011, and there are not empty seats in the public institution health care programs either. So denied a state grant at the College of St. Catharines, that student just will not go to school, even if she could afford a public institution, because she needs that state grant. A hockey player from the Iron Range, a single mother, a displaced worker, a new immigrant, these are who St. Catharines students are. When they graduate, they stay in Minnesota as business leaders, as teachers, as nurses, physicians, and healthcare workers, as social workers, as entrepreneurs, and importantly, as parents and taxpayers. In my view, it is just not helpful to think of the private colleges, MinSU and the U, as somehow engaged in a zero-sum game with each other over state financial aid. In fact, the state is blessed and stronger and better because of the presence of a dynamic array of two-year, four-year, and graduate public and private colleges. Thousands of students around Minnesota depend on grants for basic access to higher education, including nearly one-third of St. Catharines' 3,600 undergraduate students. Digging down into the data reveals some startling statistics for students at every degree level at St. Catharines. For example, in our School of Health, our associate degree nursing students and our graduate students in physical therapy, a burgeoning field that will only grow as the population ages, 40 and 66% respectively report incomes that are below 200% of the federal poverty level. About one-third of our baccalaureate nursing and occupational therapy students are the first in their family to attend college. Clearly, the state grant program is critical to making St. Catharines and other state private colleges and universities affordable to many, especially to many non-traditional, low to moderate income and part-time students. Our private colleges and their graduates play a crucial role in Minnesota's economy and its quality of life by educating those low and moderate income students, some, many of whom are the first in their families to attend college, and also some of them, the brightest and the best, are cutting-edge thinkers for the future. 90% of St. Catharines students are Minnesota residents, and they continue to live and work in the state after graduation, strengthening Minnesota's tax base and enriching the state in so many ways. I do not envy you your work, but I understand its complexities and its vexing challenges. Too many legitimate needs, not enough money, economic distress, and clamoring from every quarter on why their needs should be funded. At St. Catharines during these difficult times, we have worked very hard to put the financial aid needs of students first. This will most likely mean no pay increases for our employees this year, already substantially underpaid relative to their peers, especially in public institutions. It has meant cutbacks at every level of college spending this year, and a directive from me as we prepare the budget for next year to anticipate significant cuts. Our community is strong and willing to endure whatever it takes to keep students in school and their colleagues employed. There is not fat in our budget. We offer a first-rate education to thousands of students who are unable to afford it. Our help from the state of Minnesota comes only in the form of state grants and child care assistance. The federal government provides Pell Grants for one-third of our undergraduates, and millions of dollars of loan money comes into the college each year. Surprisingly, our students have an enviably low federal loan default rate of less than 1%. Our modest endowments are almost exclusively directed to financial aid. Our operations are lean and getting leaner. We have made substantial effort to hold tuition increases down, although 80% of our expenses are go for faculty and staff salaries and benefits. I will argue that the state of Minnesota's relatively small investment in state grants is one with a powerfully convincing rate of return. For example, no one besides the University of Minnesota graduates more healthcare workers than St. Catharines in the state. 95% of our graduates are employed in Minnesota, that graduated from last May, are employed in Minnesota and will remain here. The state has invested a small amount of money in these graduates, in some of these graduates, and the return on investment is hard to overestimate. I will rest my case now and promise you three things. First, whatever help St. Catherine can offer as you proceed with your difficult work. Second, I can promise you that you will never need to worry about being able to document clear return on your investment for state grant dollars invested at St. Catherine or at any of the other private colleges in the state. And third, I promise you my personal prayer and best wishes for wisdom and good energy as you engage in this very difficult work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sister. I appreciate the last promise more than anything, believe me. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Dr. Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Brian Rosenberg, and I'm the president of McAllister College. I wish I could offer you my prayers with the same impact as the president. I offer you my best wishes nonetheless, and my thanks for listening to me this afternoon. I want to begin my brief remarks by quoting one paragraph from a long piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine last week on the relations between various factors and economic growth. And David Leonard, who wrote that piece on the basis of a great deal of research, wrote the following. There really is no mystery about why education would be the lifeblood of economic growth. On the most basic level, education helps people figure out how to make objects and accomplish tasks more efficiently. It allows companies to make complex products that the rest of the world wants to buy, and thus creates high-wage jobs. It helps the society leverage every other investment it makes, be it in medicine, transportation, or alternative energy. Education, educating more people and educating them better, appears to be the single best bet that a society can make. So I want to thank all of you for taking the time and energy to think about that investment for our state. As I understand that, I've been asked to address two fundamental questions this afternoon. The first is, how is the economic downturn affecting McAllister College? And the second is, what is McAllister College doing in response to those impacts? And I will speak briefly to both of those questions. McAllister essentially has three sources of revenue. Income from our endowment, income from fundraising, and the tuition that students pay the college. Each of those sources of revenue has been dramatically affected by the current economic situation, and I think for obvious reasons. Our endowment is conservatively invested in an attempt to balance gains against risk. Nonetheless, as you'd expect in the current environment, with virtually all investments well down, our endowment has lost a great deal of its value. It's lost, over the last several months, about 20% of its value. It looks good in relation to my own retirement account. But as you'd expect, that has had a significant impact on the college's operating budget. We spend about 5% of our endowment using a 16-quarter trailing average formula in our operating budget every year. Our endowment has lost about $150 million since the beginning of the economic downturn. That will have an impact on our operating budget, not simply this year or next, but for at least 4 or 5 years into the future. That income typically provides about one-third of our operating budget. The second source of income for us is fundraising. As you'd imagine, this is the most difficult fundraising environment I have encountered in my adult lifetime. Our alumni and other supporters are being as generous as they can, but they have been impacted, as have all of us, by the current economy. And so at McAllister, and I think this is typical of most private colleges, we're seeing decreases of anywhere from 15 to 25% in the annual funds upon which we depend for part of our operating budget. The single largest contributor to our operating budget is tuition revenue. And for all, again, of the obvious reasons, we expect tuition revenue, the amount that students are able to pay to attend McAllister, to be dramatically affected by the current economic situation. McAllister has a policy of meeting the full economic need, the full financial need of every student it admits to the college. Close to 70% of our students receive need-based financial aid, and we provide financial aid packages that fully meet their needs through a combination of mostly grants with some loans and some work study. We expect the number of students who require financial aid to increase, and we expect the amount of financial aid they require in order to attend the college to increase. So overall, we are expecting a sharp decrease in the revenues that come into the college relative to what we would have expected a year ago. As a consequence of that, obviously, if you have fewer dollars coming in, you have to have fewer dollars going out. So we are doing a number of things in response to what we anticipate in terms of revenue. The first, and in many ways the most important and most costly, is a dramatic increase in our financial aid budget. I think it's important for me to give you some sense of the scope and scale of our financial aid budget. At McAllister College, our entire budget for everything, people, programs, buildings, grounds, everything we do, with the exception of financial aid, next year will be about $85 million. Our budget for financial aid alone will be $31 million. So we spend about 40% as much on financial aid, on making the college accessible to students, as we spend on everything else combined. We are anticipating, in a typical year, we anticipate that our financial aid budget will go up year to year about $2 million. Next year, we are budgeting for twice that increase. So we are increasing our financial aid budget next year by about $4 million in order to try to keep the college accessible to our new students and to our current students. Obviously, those are dollars that will not be available for programs and expenses at the college. So at McAllister, as at St. Kate's, we are anticipating in all likelihood a salary freeze for the vast majority of our employees. We are attempting to preserve some sort of increase for employees at the lower end. Our health insurance costs next year are going up 15.5%. The college absorbs some of those costs and passes some of them along to our employees. What we're trying to do is mitigate the impact of that increase on our lower paid employees. We are looking at programmatic cuts in the range of 5 to 10% in most programs at the college. We are either slowing down or halting a number of capital projects at the college. And I would emphasize that those capital projects provide a lot of jobs to a lot of people in the city and in the state. The last I heard, unemployment in the state in the construction industry was running as high as 18%. And so as you see these projects on college campuses come to a halt, it doesn't just have an impact on individual campuses, but it has an impact on all of the contractors and all of the subcontractors who would otherwise be doing that work. We are not, I want to emphasize, slowing down our draw from our endowment. We are continuing to draw heavily on the endowment to underwrite the education of our students. So most of that additional financial aid, in effect, will come from our own endowment. We receive in total, between state grants and federal Pell grants, about $1.2 million in state and federal help in the financial aid we provide. And again, that compares with about $30 million that we provide from our own funds. So we will be using our endowed funds, our own funds, to try to provide additional help for students in these economic times. We are trying to make more efficient and effective use of our facilities. So we're looking at spreading out our class times so that we can use our facilities more hours during the day and therefore make more efficient use of them. We're trying a variety of things to help us conserve energy costs. We have replaced every single light bulb on campus with a high-efficiency light bulb, which is a significant initial outlay, but which over time will pay itself back many times over. The newest building that we are building on campus that will open this spring will in all likelihood be a LEED Platinum building. That's the highest level of energy efficiency that one can obtain from the Green Building Council. The building will, in effect, have a zero carbon footprint. It will, for all intents and purposes, use no energy to heat and cool itself because of the way it's designed. And so we're trying to conserve costs and also be environmentally responsible by the way we design, build, and refurbish our buildings. So we are trying in every way possible to reduce our expenses without having a negative impact on either the accessibility of the college for the quality of the education that we provide to our students. As you would imagine, that is an extremely difficult trick. To manage simultaneously, to keep the college accessible, to keep its quality high, and to keep costs down all at the same time is not easy. And what it will require in the near term, I think, is a fair amount of sacrifice from our employees. They're prepared to make that sacrifice. They believe strongly in the mission of the college and the importance of keeping the college accessible. Together, all of these factors are placing a considerable strain on what we are trying to do with our students. Thank you for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Eastman.
Just walked in, so maybe I'm, there's an obvious answer to this, but I just heard you say that you use zero energy to heat and cool a building. Could you tell me how you do that?
We have we provide our own heating and cooling from our campus plant. And so the additional energy that this building is so well insulated and designed in such a way to lose so little heat in the winter and so little cold air in the summer. It's designed to have, as the warm air leaves the building, it passes through the cold air coming into the building and automatically warms it up through the exchange of energy without using any power. So the combination of the insulation in the building, the way it's designed, and that exchange of air will mean that it will add no load to our campus heating plant, even though it's adding about 16,000 square feet of building space. So it will, in effect, be an energy-neutral building.
For both of you, what is the current tuition then at St. Kate's and Calvin?
The undergraduate, we have like a number of different sectors of enrollment, but for the undergrad, the traditional 18-year-old day student, about $25,600 just for tuition.
And what's happened in the last, let's say since 2003, when the public tuition really escalated after the massive cuts back then? What's happened in that little historical time period at St. Kate's?
Well, we've increased tuition every year, but we each year when we increase tuition, we also increase, as Brian just said, the financial aid budget so that the impact on students won't be that great. So in other words, we don't realize we raise tuition 5% next year, 4%, whatever it would be, or 3%. Whatever the dollars that would yield in terms of the gross tuition revenue, a significant portion of that would be redirected back to students in terms of financial aid. And the purpose of that, at least at St. Catherine's, is to have the families that can afford to pay closer to the true cost of education and to subsidize those students who can't.
Okay, thank you. Doctor?
Tuition at McAllister this year is about $36,000. It has gone up every year, as just Andrea said. Next year we anticipate that we've in fact already announced the tuition increase will be about 4%. I would emphasize again, as I said earlier, that only about 30% of the students at McAllister, about 30%, pay full tuition. The other percent have their education to one degree or another subsidized by the institution. The average amount of that subsidy is quite large. The average amount of the financial aid received by McAllister students who receive the aid is well in excess of $20,000. So one of the reasons of the rapid escalation in the sticker price of private colleges and universities is the number of students whose financial aid is underwritten by the institution and the extent of that underwriting. The average cost to us of doing what we do per student is well in excess of that $36,000 figure. The difference is made up, in our case, by the income that comes from our endowment. It probably costs about 20% on top of that full price to educate students. About 65% of that cost is in the form of people. About 65% of our operating budget is in salaries and benefits for our faculty and our staff. That is overwhelmingly the largest driver of our budget, and increases in compensation costs has been overwhelmingly the largest driver in increases in tuition.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Hannah, Murphy.
sister brought it up, the sister, and so I'm just going to ask why the name change.
We can meet afterwards.
Okay.
Actually, the decision to become a university really is to more accurately reflect the scope of the program offerings at the college that range from two-year associate degree programs all the way up to doctorates right now. We still have the women's baccalaureate program at the heart, but that's why the name changed. I just wanted to add a little PS to what Brian said in terms of the relationship between tuition increases and financial aid. St. Catherine's, the tuition income that is supported by federal Pell or Minnesota state grants is about $6 million a year. So we have a lot of students who are lower income, and we don't have a great big endowment. So that's good news and bad news right now, I guess, because we're not, our operating budget isn't dependent upon it, but it makes our students very much more loan dependent because their family contribution to their education based on their FAFSA assessment is often very low. We have virtually no full-pay students.
No, sister, I always relied heavily on the advice of my non-fat aunt. So let me ask you this question.
Uh-oh, I'm holding on.
Heaven forbid if you were me, but if you were faced with what we're faced with, which could easily be a $7 billion deficit by the end of this month, how would you balance this budget so we don't have to hurt as many people as I think are going to get hurt? Maybe that's an unfair
question. Well,
you know, you can answer like my other nuns did, too. Tommy, we don't need to answer that question.
No, I will make one answer, because I think I said some of it in my remarks, that whether your budget has six zeros at the end of it or 22 zeros at the end of it, I think good decisions are going to come when you get good energy around a common purpose, and that's the way we're dealing with the budget constraints we have at St. Kate's right now. I think Brian would say the same in terms of people at McAllister, and I think the way to solve the state's budget issue without getting into details of what should go where is to really work hard at getting unanimity around some common goals and purpose, and then the decisions will follow.
Mr. Chairman, though I'm not a nun, am I allowed to provide an answer as well?
And I was going to ask you next, Doctor, believe me.
You know, I've lived in Minnesota now for almost 6 years. I'm originally from the East Coast. When I didn't live in Minnesota, one of the things that I'd always heard about the state, one of the things that always attracted me to the state, and one of the things that really attracted me to McAllister, was the reputation in Minnesota for having a very high degree of civic consciousness, very high quality of life, very high willingness to support those things that it seems to me in a free and democratic society it's our responsibility to support. And those include education and health care and taking care of those who have the greatest need. I think it's a tradition in that state to do that responsibly and do that well. I acknowledge that we are arguably faced with a challenge now, and it's tempting to continue to do that, that is larger than any we've faced in a long, long time. It is my belief, and I speak personally, that we can't do this simply through cuts. That is, that we have to also look for ways to increase revenue. Nobody likes to talk about tax increases, particularly in this environment. But if we attempt to solve this problem simply through cutting, then I think that reputation that we have nationally for providing a higher quality of life than many other parts of the country, the things that draw people here, the education, the health care, the parks and recreation, all of those things will be at risk, and we will be calling into risk the long-term future of the state. There are many, many needs. Many are acute and short-term, some are less acute and longer-term. I cannot resist, given my role and the nature of my beliefs, emphasizing again that I think the single most important investment that any civil society can make, and there is an infinite amount of research to support this, is in education. there is a direct correlation between the rate of increase in participation in higher education and the rate of increase in gross domestic product. From the 1950s until the 1980s, when the rate of participation in higher education increased most steeply in the United States, the rate of increase in our gross domestic product increased most steeply. When those rates of participation began to level off in the 80s, so too did our gross domestic product. And what we're seeing right now is that the wage increases among women, whose participation in higher education has increased by 30%, have tracked very closely those increases, whereas the wage increases among men, whose participation in higher education has for about the last 15 years leveled off, have also leveled off. There is a close and direct correlation between economic growth and higher education, and it's been proven for a long, long time. So as we wrestle with this, I think all of us need to think about the near term and also about the medium and the long term.
After that answer, you can pray for me, too. Any other questions?
The same result.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Ms. Johnson, if you don't mind, can we move those other, the students that are here from, or do you have a student too? No? You might? Okay, thank you. Why don't we then have the Career College Association come down, Ms. Herman, and the students that are going to be testifying. And so we can fit Ms. Johnson and two students, if you can, you know, keep your testimony. I don't know how many of you are going to actually be talking, Ms. Herman, but so maybe, you know, let's see, how many are going to be speaking? A couple of minutes? Two students?
Three
students. Okay, if we could keep it maybe to about 5 minutes or so each student, it would be fine. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Certainly. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeannie Herman. I'm here representing the career colleges. I appreciate the time that you're giving us, but I also understand the important thing that you want to hear from us today is those stories that our students are about to tell you. While we do represent nearly 21,000 students in our state, I want to quickly draw your attention to the brochure that is included in your packets today. It tells you about our member schools, what we do for students, and what we do for the workforce of our state. I would love an opportunity to come back to the committee so that I can further explain what our sector does for higher education in the state. But at this time, I'd like to turn it over to our students. If, at a minimum, they could all introduce themselves and maybe talk about the program they're in their colleges, and then we could bring the three speakers up.
Yes, please do.
Thank
come
you.
Forward. Come on forward, please. And if you want, just however you want to do it, come up, introduce yourself, and then who's ever going to stay at the table, just go ahead.
My name is Jennifer Meering, and I'm a student at Pershing College in the Drafting and Design Technology.
Thank you.
I'm Bonnie Carlson, and I am at Pershing as well, and I'm for medical assistance.
Thank you.
My name is Nicole Mollenhoff. I'm at Globe University, getting a bachelor's in business management, emphasis in marketing.
Thanks.
I'm Brad Zonowski, Duluth Business University, Duluth, in graphic design.
Thanks.
I'm Sam Cohen, representing the Art Institute International of Minnesota and a hospitality management.
My name is Stacey Larson. I'm from Masterson College in St. Cloud, and I'm going to paralegal.
Thank you, Stacey.
I'm Rhonda Johnson, and I'm going to Masterson College in St. Cloud for medical office management.
All of you, welcome very much to the committee. And who's ever going to come forward, you said three students, just come on forward, sit down, have a seat, make yourself comfortable. And Representative Haas, did you have a question right now?
No.
Oh, Representative Murphy?
I just wanted to know where her thing was.
Okay. Welcome. Whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman.
And you probably unidentify yourself again, just for the tape.
Okay, my name is Rhonda Johnson. I go to Rasmussen College in St. Cloud. I'm in the Medical Office Management Program. They asked me to come and talk to you about why state grants and funding is so important for me myself. I'm a non-traditional student. I'm 41 years old. My world was turned upside down, and I needed better education, higher education, and a good career for my future. I went to several different colleges, and I found that Rasmussen had what I really needed, which was smaller class sizes and the technology I needed to learn. It's not review for me like it is for some of the students that come just out of high school. I needed to learn everything. And I think Rasmussen did a wonderful, wonderful job of teaching me the basics in 6 months. And from there, I can go on further. I'm doing very well in my classes simply because I think the classes are so small and we have so much help on campus. We have tutors available all the time. We have student tutors. We have a tutor center that's open every day, even Saturday if we need. We have classes available to us on campus and online, which I take advantage of both. I'm in the work-study program, so I work and I go to school. And without the funding, it just would not be possible for me to start a whole new life.
Well, Rhonda, thank you. So when your medical, you were said you were in medical technology?
Medical office management.
Medical office management, okay. And that's a two-year?
Yes.
You're in your second year then?
Yes.
And so are you going to graduate with some debt or a lot of debt? Or?
About $20,000.
Oof, that's fine. Okay, well, maybe you can tutor me on how to use technology. Still not that good at myself. Representative Mahoney.
And Mr. Chair, you know, there are some things in life we should all just give up on, and I think you know the one that you should. But my question for you and the other students as you go along, the grants that you've received, how have you financed it? And I don't really need the dollar figure, but maybe percentages as to grants versus loans versus your own personal funds, whether it's through work or savings or something else. And certainly can incorporate that as the other two people talk. But
Ms. Johnson, go ahead.
I will have received about $4,000 in funding, grants, and Pell grants, and I will need to take out about I am taking out about $20,000 in debt on my own. The funding, basically, the little extra that is there, I use for gas money, and with the work study, I use that for rent and food.
So how much work study do you get then a week?
20 hours.
Okay. All righty, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the delivery of your education. Are you on campus? Are you taking classes online?
Both.
Okay, and is it during the day or at night when the classes that you have?
The classes I have are during the day, and they do offer classes in the evening.
And what would you say the percentage of the classes are that you're taking that are online?
I'm taking 4 online classes right now and 1 on campus.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this goes for all 3 testifiers. Your institutions, do they have placement services? And what is the percentage over the past in terms of placing graduates into jobs?
I'm with Globe University, and
just identify yourself.
I apologize. Nicole Mollenhoff.
Okay, Nicole.
They have 70 to 100% job placement, lifetime job placement. So in this current economic conditions that we're in, this is happening to me 20 years from now after I graduate. I can go back to Globe and they will continue to look for a new job or new career for me as a graduate.
I'm Brad Nolan, Duluth Business University. And we as well have a very high rate for getting people in the field right away. Again, I'm speaking for the graphic design program, but there's also other vet technician and different aspects of DBU that I can't speak for, but because of the small class sizes and that these people leave the school after they graduate ready to roll in the workplace, they are qualified to be a graphic design artist and have no problem getting jobs that way. And that's why you get a high rate like that. So.
At my college, 98% of the students will get a job in the field that they studied for. And right now with my work study, I found that with school helping me get my work study job, it's opened up all different avenues for me, all different relationships with people within the community. So it's really helped.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. With that placement, did they indicate, you know, what would be the starting benefits and salary for those jobs that you are looking for?
Depending on the degree or the emphasis that you choose to go into, they do give you a breakdown of the employers that the school works with to place students into after graduation, along with dollar figures. In the bachelor's, I looked at either doing an associate's program or a bachelor's program, and it was about $45,000 starting. I don't recall if it was 2-year or 4-year.
And Brian, do you have anything to add?
I can say that, you know, for our field, it's such a broad subject that you can get many different monetary values for what you want to work for. We have a number of subjects that are mothers and wanted a part-time job out of this and have received that. So it really depends on where you want to take it. Again, you can do flyers for your kids' grade school or sell ads, on the Super Bowl or whatever you want to do. It's your own way of it.
Okay. I don't know. Nicole, do you want to go next then? Just quickly add in.
Sure. A little bit about me. I came from the mortgage industry. I was in finance and doing mortgages for about 6 years. I started in Virginia and then moved out here. I've been in Minnesota now for about 4.5 years. After being laid off from one position, moving into another, which brought me into a 100% commission position, and the economic conditions that we're in, my income went from slim to none. So the only options I had was to go out and interview. I interviewed for different positions with different companies, pretty much anything to find something to bring in an income. And every single one of those jobs said to me, I would love to hire you, but you do not have a degree. To me, this was a big hit because I have never really had much of a problem finding jobs in the past that I guess I got to a point in life where there was only so far I could go. So the next opportunity I had was to go to school. Globe University is 3 blocks away from my house. It was my first choice, went in, met with some instructors, talked to the faculty in admissions. Everybody was great. It's so far, this is my fourth quarter, and I have absolutely loved it. I am on an accelerated program. I'm trying to do my bachelor's in 2 years and 3 months versus the 3 years on their program. And doing everything I can to save money at the same time. I get approximately $3,000 a year in state grants, which is greatly appreciated. But on top of it, the school offers, after 16 credits, you don't have to pay for your additional credits. So I take 5 classes a quarter, which allows me 4 credits at, right now, $390 credit that I'm not paying for. So in accelerating my program is trying to save me money in the long run. I'm a full-time student as well, or a full-time employee as well. I am a server as my college job to make ends meet until I can get back into the workforce.
Another capacity.
Exactly. Hopefully doing something. Unbelievably, I actually miss the corporate world.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Malinowski.
Yes. I don't have a lot of figures, and I was listening earlier. I feel kind of short for that because that's what everybody
feels. I feel that way all the time. I don't feel bad.
Well, it seems that that's what everybody here is understanding, and that's obviously what we're talking about, is bottom lines and budget cuts, and this is money. And reflecting, though, I can see I'm very comparable to the people that I'm sitting around or seeing in a private college. About the same amount of money, about $4,000 in state grants is there, and we were talking about that, my instructor that I came down with, and she was saying that, no, I'm telling her, I'm working full-time as well. And to do that, to put 40 hours in here and take that full, you know, 15 sometimes credits is a lot to do. It takes out a lot. But the grant gives you that point where you don't necessarily have to do the 40-hour week. Maybe you do the 32 hours a week and you keep up with all your school things with it. But I did write some things down in the fact that I thought maybe I would get a chance to talk, so maybe one of you had got to read this at a later date. But since I am here, there are three main points that I wanted to mention regarding the suspension of state grant contributions. There's one that is hard for me to comprehend, that people in the future will be denied the same opportunities that I had to pursue their education. I thought this was a great thing, and it was a big... It was a big situation that I said, wow, the state is behind me here. All of what we support in our government policies within our country, education should be number one. We as Americans are people that are constantly evolving and represented by our fellow citizens. Let us help those who want to help themselves and give them every incentive to be more tomorrow than what they are today. Secondly, how can we lessen the value of a specific type of or field of education based solely upon what kind of school is offering that program? Competition between schools is good, and all people are different. If someone is willing to further their education, it would be wise to let them choose from a variety of subjects as opposed to a limited few. The chances for the success of the program of their choice will be much better than that of one that is appointed to them. And three is to verbally express my gratitude and represent a working example of what the state grant does for me. You can see me sitting here, that I'm living proof that it is a wonderful thing, and it does apply to my everyday. I've been attending GDU for a little over 12 months, and within that time I have successfully attained the knowledge that has made me an eligible participant in the field of graphic design. And as of this month, I have started my second internship in the working world. I'm getting real life experience in my field in a little over a year's time, and I owe that to the staff at GDU, and along with the funding that I've got that pushed me to come here. I had considered many different schools in my area, but clearly Duluth Business University offered the specific program that I was interested in pursuing. If I were had to exclude DBU as a potential school because of the lack of state funding, I would be looking at almost three more years of schooling, serving, before being able to enter my profession, and I would not be standing before you today. I can remember when I was 15 years old and I signed up for driver's education class at high school. I wasn't thinking about the assignments and the hours that I would have to spend in the passenger seat learning the rules and regulations. I just wanted to drive the car. And in a sense, that's what the private college of DBU has done for me today, and probably my fellow peers here. In a traditional college, the student that is interested in entering their job market today would still be in the passenger seat, studying the rules of the road, and at DBU, I have been given the keys and taught how to drive. The dominance of the traditional students today is different than what it was years ago, and they do not necessarily carry the majority in all of the schools that are available today. Like me, there are people out there who have regrettably abandoned their initial start in college and sought refuge in the working world, and that type of student is now coming back and realizes that further education is imminent. And if it is your desire to seek a better career, that's what you need to do, and the state funding helps. I can tell you firsthand that in order to integrate a full-time school schedule into your current full-time job and home life is not an easy task at all. More often than not, we make sacrifices that impede our work schedules and families, that in turn deplete ourselves emotionally and financially. And during these times, it is a great peace of mind knowing that the state, by the way of its contributions, it's supporting your hard efforts and is encouraging your will to better yourself. This is a conscious act of improving your life that you have embarked on, and the sacrifices that you make during this show your loyalty to the program that you're working. This is not a free meal. It's a supplement to tide us over. We are looking at the end result, which is to alleviate our dependence on the state and all other agencies. We seek independence and self-sufficiency. The state funding we receive is necessary for survival during this time in our lives, and keeps us from coming apart when times get tough, like buying gas and such. In review, I want to reiterate that it is detrimental to our society that to discontinue teacher state funding to private schools. We should not deny any of the new education seekers the opportunity to receive support from their local state for pursuit of their education. Let us keep this gift alive. Secondly, we should not discriminate on what kinds of education people pursue. Let us support individuality and stand behind what field of study a person chooses to enter. We are Americans and we are proud of our differences. And finally, thank you. Thank you for helping me to be what I have become today. I stand before you a person that has changed for the better as a direct result from the contributions received through your institution. And that is a sincere thank you from me. Thank you.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for your story, and good luck to you. And, Brian, I don't know who told you that there's going to be a suspension of the state grant program, but somebody was BSing you, quite frankly. So, any other questions then with that? Representative Poffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask the other two about their delivery, if it's on campus or if it's online, and you testified that it's an accelerated program. Just if you could talk about how that's being delivered to you or how you're being able to accomplish that.
Ms. Bona.
Definitely. I take all three, day, night, and online classes. I, again, as a server, I need to be flexible, and Globe University gives me that option. I take morning classes on residentially so that I can work my noon shift, and I take one night class a week right now, this quarter, so that I'm only taking one evening off from work. I have my bills to pay, so I have to be able to work as much as I can while getting my education. Right now, I'm currently taking three online classes.
Thank you. Brian?
I myself have, I've taken one online class, but I can still pull full-time credits throughout every time. I've done some internships where they're also taking up time, paid and unpaid. So I'm not sure. What was the exact question you're looking for? It was directed to the two ladies. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just how you are receiving your education, if it's on campus, if you're going in, or if you're doing it online, and if it's daytime or evening time, how it's set up.
Yes. Well, the schedule is diverse there. We have night classes, day classes. I take a few online classes. I am taking some generals. But graphic design is a very hands-on course. You do have to, it's not a class that you'd want to take online. You'd want to be there with the instructors, and again, that is what makes the class great, because of the fact that you get the hands-on and the direct contact with the instructors.
Okay. Quickly, Mr. Donnelly, why don't you come down to Capella University while President Donnelly's asking the last question. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Actually, it's a question about the statistics on the back page of your brochure.
Well, then we'll have Ms. Herman.
Yes, I think it is by Ms. Herman.
Students, thank you very much.
Thank
Ms.
You.
Herman, you want to come back for a second? Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You seem to have a much higher retention and grad rates, and I'm wondering if you've kind of studied that for comparison's sake. Educate us on maybe why that is.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We provide additional services to students. Our tuition is higher than the public schools. The students, in my opinion, are paying a premium for the services that we provide. So we're ensuring that we're holding their hand along the way to help them towards their career goals. One of the things we do is we try to do it in a shorter period of time so that students can see the light at the end.
We also offer career-specific courses so that they're, you know, in their first quarter, their second quarter, they're getting involved in their career focus right away so that they're feeling part of the process and feeling part of the career that they're going to be entering. We also have the small class sizes, the individual attention, the tutoring that they spoke of. All those services are available to our students in order to help them retain and eventually graduate.
Okay. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee. And if you'll just identify yourself, all of you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Riccovina, members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking the time to have us here. My name is Christine Johnson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Capella University. And Dr. Chris Kassir, our university president, is with me. We'll give you a quick overview of Capella University, its history, and where we are today. And then Keith Cook, our Director of Next Generation Learning, will give the committee just a taste of what online learning actually looks like. There's a lot of discussion about it, but I don't know if you're anything like me. When I decided to go back to school in 2004 to get my master's degree, that was my first experience with online learning, so I don't know if everyone in this committee has had a chance to actually see what it looks like, but that's what we wanted to bring to you today. So with that, then I'll kick it off to the university president.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here. We appreciate the opportunity to share with you a little bit about what online learning looks like at Capella.
And just identify yourself.
Oh, okay. Chris Kassir from Capella University. I'm the acting president, so thank you, sir. You know, there are, my folks know that I could probably talk all day long and keep you here much longer than you'd like, so I'll try to be brief, but it's a challenge.
We're limiting discussion.
let me talk first about Capella's philosophy of education, because it's really critical to understanding why online is the right delivery mechanism and our commitment to doing it. So we're working with the technology. I apologize for that. First of all, Capella's mission, which you'll read about, is extending access to higher education for essentially working adults. And what's at the center of that is a commitment to recognizing that there are really no limits to what any human being can achieve in their lifetime. While folks are given messages throughout from early childhood on that they can or can't be certain things in their lives, Capella approaches our adult learners with the assumption that I have no idea what you are capable of achieving, and every adult has the right to a chance to succeed at higher education. Second is that we bring together a very strong and highly skilled group of business people and marry their skill set with our academic learning model to create synergy, to challenge assumptions about how educational institutions can be run, how to leverage technology to deliver learning in a different way. And while there certainly are questions and I would say a lack of understanding about how that can be done effectively and with good conscience, the facts are that we are delivering something that I find actually surpasses the educational experience I was ever able to create as a professor. I spent most of my career as a traditional academic at some great institutions, including the Carleton School at the University of Minnesota, George Washington University. My own education was quite privileged, despite having grown up in an Irish Catholic poor family in New Jersey and going back to school after a short career as an iron worker. You know, this is about delivering an educational experience that is extraordinary, that meets the needs of working adults, that brings together the best of business thinking with an academic learning model, and we're creating something new. And the third part, which really speaks to me as a teacher, is the part that happens in the heart of most of the folks who come to Capella and are willing to suspend contempt prior to investigation and actually look at what's going on inside. and that's that we garden our learners in, we do not weed them out. This is about surrounding adults who have a variety of responsibilities and challenges with the resources they need to help them be successful. And when we do that, we have an opportunity to get fundamentally focused on assessing academic competency to move forward. The Capella Learner is, in fact, we have 26,000 approximately, 70% of those are women, so about 18,000. We are in every state in the United States and 55 countries, but primarily domestically focused in the U.S. The average learner is not only female, but also approximately 40 years of age, is a working professional in some area that we represent in the university's portfolio of schools and programs, and 40% of those represent some minority group. And while I certainly wouldn't want to be quoted on this because I don't have the actual statistics, we believe we are among the top institutions in the country who are granting graduate degrees to members of minority populations. So we are serving a very different group of people with a very different set of needs. My own experience is that I don't think it's a reasonable or a responsible question to ask a working mom whether she has to choose between driving her child to ballet recital or her son to, or daughter to soccer practice or drive to the local university to sit in class at night and go to school, when education can be delivered very effectively in a superior way online. We are able to create a learning experience that I again will say I was not able to create as a traditional professor. Every faculty member at Capella must interact with the students every week. Every student must interact with every student. As a president, I am fundamentally focused on only one thing, and that is the success of my learners. That's it. I am worried about academic quality. I am worried about faculty management. I am worried about making sure that everybody who graduates from Capella has the best competencies and the skills they need to be successful. So there's a lot I can say, but really the best way to understand Capella is to have an opportunity to step inside and to really begin to look at how learning can be created online in a different way. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Keith Cook, who, as Christine said, leads Next Generation Learning at Capella and has leadership responsibility for helping ensure that we are using technology in a way that promotes great learning and interaction with our learners. So, Keith.
Mr. Cook, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And my name is Keith Cook, and I'm Director of Next Generation Learning at Capella. I operate a team that works on both the online courses and on the online website at Capella to serve our diverse population, as Chris said. As with a traditional university, we look at the university student from beginning to end, all the way from when they begin to look at what school they're going to, helping them find the right program or to match their professional needs and personal goals, through choosing and applying to school, and then inside the courseroom, which I'm going to demystify a little bit for you. But all with the goal of this end game, which is graduation and becoming an alumni, using those skills in a professional workplace. At Capella University, it's all online. Campus is online, the courseroom is online, all the interaction occurs online. So at the center, the heart of that online user experience is the courseroom. We wrap that with a layer of community experience where people informally interact with faculty, support staff, and with each other. And then we have a bunch of portal experiences online that are self-service, like registration, how to buy books, and all of those kinds of things. So very much like a traditional university in its concept, but all delivered online. Like a traditional university, we have a team of people working on developing good curriculum and good courses. However, I enable my team, a group of technology experts, to support them in areas that they may not have expertise. A psychology faculty member needs to worry about knowing psychology, does not need to worry about how the computer operates. INSO, we've won a lot of design awards for course development and design, industry awards that are actually peer-reviewed by faculty and from traditional universities and so on,
that actually vote on and choose the award winner. So not industry awards in the way that a vendor who we pay money ends up selecting the winner based on who pays the most money to that vendor, but peer-reviewed across a number of institutions. We have a variety of different technologies on campus. If you can't just buy a learning platform and expect to have online learning like Capella University, the big shield here represents how much we add value in our high-quality faculty, the faculty training we have. Faculty have to go through 6 weeks of training before they're ever allowed to teach a course. My staff, the award-winning course development team, and a bunch of services that surround the learner to make them successful. As Chris said, we try to garden in rather than weed out, believing in their human potential and looking for them to succeed. This is a representation of the black box of traditional education, where you end up being able to take courses, course after course, week after week, doing lots of assignments that lead you to that program and diploma. That is the end goal, is the diploma. At Capella, we really look at this as a requirements-based situation. What are the competencies that are required to be a successful professional in the industry, whether that be psychology, business, education, health and human services? And we map backwards to what are the competencies we need to both teach but then also measure. Every week's activities, whether that's a discussion question in week three or a paper that you turn in at the end of the course or a project plan that you have to develop to prove your competency, are all mapped to these competencies and outcomes, which make for a better meaning for that program and profession and gives us a lot more resources to give to those particular individuals who graduate and then become strong professionals in their career. So for learners, they all start at Capella University's website, capella.edu. They log in. This is a secure web environment where we give each learner a username. They choose a password that's secure. They enter our portal. Our portal is a website that has not only their courses that they're taking this particular quarter, they can access courses from the past quarters that they've taken. But we wrap that, like Chris had said, in the gardening in sort of way with support resources, whether they be services, academic and administrative, so that they can focus on the learning. Inside the course room, we have a variety of different tools trying to make it as simple as possible. We lay it out very step one, two, three, the syllabus, the learning units, and different settings that they can personally set for their course room. Syllabus is consistent across the entire campus in its categories, but each course has its own unique description and competencies laid out to the learner, but they don't have to learn from going from course to course or professor to professor how this course is going to operate. It's very consistent, and that helps with the adult learner focusing on the learning rather than focusing on what sort of format this week and this course is going to take versus last course they have taken. Inside the learning units, learners tend to have a certain pattern about them, and that has more to do with learners are in our programs are all 40-year-old working adult professionals. We don't prescribe a pattern of behavior during a given week. They are able to, you know, as Chris said, be able to go to Susie's soccer game on Thursday and not have to worry about having class on Thursday night. They can participate on Wednesday night. They can participate in the morning before work. They can participate at lunchtime. But every week, learners are interacting with each other and interacting with faculty members. So every unit has an introduction. This is what you're going to learn this week. The objectives and activities pages talk about specifically, again, back to those competencies, what is the purpose of this week's activities? Drawing that to be very practical for the learner so that they engage with the learning as if it's going to be useful to them in their job and in their profession. Within there, we have lots of different audio and video elements. I won't go through a lot of them, but I'll show you some of the samples of what we can do at Capella University being fully online. Here's an audio piece.
My name is Joe Pasquarella. Presently, I'm a captain in the New York Police Department. I started in public safety as a practitioner since 1991.
And what's important about this is that, first of all, this is very lightweight in terms of what sort of bandwidth is necessary. You can have a very low-speed interconnection and consume the same information.
So, Joe.
My dial-up wouldn't work, though.
Well, but Joe, are you going to play Joe? Because Joe is an interesting...
Yep.
Joe's an interesting example of a faculty member at Capella. And at the heart of our faculty community are what we call scholar practitioners. These are folks who are actually professionals in their field, who have gone back and earned PhDs, who are teaching, instructing, and also working in the field. So, for example, Joe is a member and a leader of a police group in New York City, and when the helicopter hit the plane in New York last year or so, Joe was with a group of our students teaching, and he said, and I was the dean at the time, and he said, Chris, I have to go catch a plane back to New York because my team was just called to land and help deal with this problem. So we have this interesting nexus of scholars and practitioners, people who are writing, presenting, working professionally in the field as academics, and also working professionally on the ground. And so they bring a mix of both real competencies as working professionals with academic training to create the experience at Capella. And Joe is not unique. Joe is one of many faculty at Capella who strongly represent this same kind of advanced training in both academic areas as well as in their professional field.
The other thing I was going to say about Joe and faculty like Joe is we're not limited by the geographic location of Joe. We can pick the best experts from across the country and across the world to work with because of our online format. I can record Joe digitally at a distance and be able to have this learning experience for learners, whereas we wouldn't be able to do so in a classroom basis without flying them in and such.
For example, I don't want to interrupt you, but so 18% of our learners are active military. Many of them deploy. And we have both a commitment to serve those learners and ensure that they're able to get a great education. But there are also some interesting things happening that we're studying in partnership with the American Psychological Association and others. And that is, for example, whether participation in an online program, a high-quality program like Capella, actually facilitates their reintegration following deployment, because they've been able to stay engaged and moving forward with their career objectives while they're out in the field serving the country, and they don't miss a step when they return and can simply continue on. So lots of interesting opportunities that we too didn't expect in building in this space that are now emerging as real and critical opportunities to advance learning.
Keith, if you could speed it up, we're over our time, but that's okay, and we've got questions too. So.
All right. Then there's the online discussion where a lot of the interaction happens between learners and faculty. Discussion questions are designed by the faculty that my team works with, and they engage with faculty and their peers within the course room discussing topics every week. The discussions kind of build like this in conversations. They're all done in a way that can provide basically information whenever you hit it. So if you hit it Thursday night, you can read what everybody else participated on Wednesday. But then you have a variety of media elements that help learners learn these things and these complex concepts in different ways than lecture and sort of that kind of format. We make that portable when we can, because learners are busy working adult professionals. We try to make all of this possible to consume on the train or on the bus in the morning, on any kind of plane to travel for business. You can see all the classmates within the roster tool. The assignment Dropbox is private communication between the learner and the faculty, so all of the grading happens and all of the feedback happens within this, and no other learner can see my feedback or my grades. Faculty have a unique login just like learners. They have a portal that's more focused on becoming a better instructor than being a better learner. They have a symbiotic pattern of behavior. Again, not a prescribed behavior, but a pattern that matches the learner's pattern. They have different tools that are available to them, like the grade book and tracking tools that would say which learners are in course and outside of the course, on what kind of periodic behaviors they have, as well as what their performance is in the classroom. Again, they have their own roster tool and can provide their own bio, so learners can see why I'm listening to this particular faculty and learn about Joe's experience. Announcements can be given either at the university level broadcast to all people within all these classes, or the faculty member may be able to say something like Joe did, where I'm going to be out of town for the next 3 days. I'll be back on Monday because of this engagement that I have. Faculty grade via rubrics at Capella University. Their objective grading based on performance against, again, those competencies in the field. Faculty members choose all of these demonstration levels, and then the score is auto-calculated. This all becomes mountains of data that we can use for accountability and improvements of the courses over time. Again, because we're all online, we have lots of data, and we have support resources like meetings with faculty, guest speaker lectures from the best instructors in the world. We have a great library that's all online with full text access to journals and books. We have academic self-help that isn't necessarily inside the course, that's self-directed. And again, at the end of the day, it's easy to use for a diversity of technical users, both diverse in their thought and diverse in their background. Convenient interaction, all of the course resources they need to be successful inside the course room as well as outside the course room on our portal. And at the end of the day, it's all about the graduation. I mean, making these people successful in their careers, and they're pursuing the same goals that a traditional university that's not doing any online is pursuing. They have a cap and gown when they end, and they participate with their family with the same kind of joy that a traditional university member does.
Thank you. Representative Haas moves the minutes of the Thursday meeting.
I would love to move the minutes, and I have a couple
of questions. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails, and that's why I had to move the minutes. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to know, when you're picking your professors, you're going to pick your professors because of experience, in academics. But are you going to end up with professors that have never experienced taking an online course, and how do you deal with that, or do you make sure that they have that type of experience, or do you have models, working orientations to work with them so that they have a student experience before they become an instructor or professor in this new technology or retail technology?
Whoever wants to answer.
I'd love to answer that. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, two perspectives on this for you. One is what we do, and that is any prospective person who wants to become a member of the faculty at Capella, first of all, has to have their degrees from fully accredited institutions. We have primarily graduate programs, so 85% of our students are master's or PhD students, about 15% are undergrad. Anybody teaching a graduate level course must have a PhD from an accredited institution. Second, every faculty member who comes to Capella or prospective faculty member must complete 5 weeks of unpaid training and pass a course that we have designed to make sure they know how to teach online. It is not just come in and we hope you do a great job and we'll let you know if you're not. They actually have to come and demonstrate an alignment with our values and our commitment to learning and learners. And two, a facility with being able to actually instruct online based on the teaching we provide. This is not easy, and it is very intensive and requires a real-time commitment. And about 50% of those who say they want to try and do this as prospective faculty members actually don't move forward because they think they can do this, but when they actually get in and see that it's real work, and you really have to demonstrate that you can do this according to our standards. The second perspective I'm going to offer you is as a former professor and as a former chairman at the University of Minnesota, and tell you that the way we continue to develop faculty is no professor gets to shut the door in a classroom at Capella. You know, when I was a traditional chairman, faculty would teach, the door would be closed. I had no idea what was going on in there, really,
yeah,
until the end of the semester or whatever. But I know everything. I know every interaction. I know what's happening. I know who said what. And I can study how great learning occurs online, and I do. I look at what behaviors, what communication styles, what types of interactions actually promote progress toward the achievement of competency. That is a brand new area of opportunity in the whole field of academic instruction.
And so those two perspectives are critical to understand, because we use that information from a management standpoint, from a faculty management standpoint, to make sure our chairs are getting reports, getting feedback, and interacting. And again, this is where I'm fundamentally focused. So you might think it's a stunt for me to say, I know Joe, but I know Joe, and I know almost all of my faculty, particularly those who are full-time, because that's my job. So I know what they're doing, and I know how they're interacting, and I know that they're interacting in the way that we expect them to interact or not, and we manage to it.
Just another question here. Is a certain amount of your curriculum interactive, if or immediate interactive by chat line, so that you have a group conversation going on, or is it all delayed interaction?
I'll offer a perspective, and I'll ask Keith to comment from a technology standpoint. Just to make this clear, while we are 100% online, for all of our doctoral students, they are required to come together for 3 one-week face-to-face learning experiences. And so we, like a professional conference, go to about 14 cities around the country throughout the year and basically take over a hotel complex, and it becomes Capella University on site. And so our doctoral students all have to participate in intensive 5-day-long, we call them residencies, with their faculty, with the university, learning research skills and other things that are critical. We also have we are the first university, and have held this title for 4 years, to have earned something called K-CREP accreditation. We had the only mental health counseling program that was fully accredited by the Gold Standard Accrediting Agency. And that clinical program requires students to come together for face-to-face learning as part of their curriculum to help them develop skills. So where it's fundamentally necessary for that face-to-face learning to occur, we absolutely provide it, and we make the same commitment to doing that extraordinarily well. There are also other ways that learners interact through the technology, which allows that intimacy to be created that you might not expect. You might not expect it, but it's actually incredibly high. When I taught, I would know maybe 5 of my students at the end of the semester. You know, they're all sitting in class, but be honest, I don't know if you'd find a professor who would say, I know every one of my students. You don't. You know 5, 10 in a class of 20. At Capella, they all have to know their students. They have to. We can see it, we can look at it, we can study it.
Well, I think we're going to give Representative Detmer the last question here.
Okay.
And then we got to get out of the room because the next committee is coming in 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, being in the military myself, I've taken several online courses through the military, their secure websites. How do you handle with a military personnel who is, say, in Iraq, taking a course, and all of a sudden, boom, he's out for 3, 4, 5 weeks away? How do you handle that schedule?
Every learner at Capella is surrounded by a team of people, which is also different than you might find in a traditional academic environment. Whereas in a traditional environment, the professor is professor, teacher, mentor, friend, advisor, marketer, all those things to the university. That role at Capella is unbundled. So we have experts in advising who work closely with every learner, and we have specialized advisors who work specifically with our learners in the military, who can make sure that when those things happen, we are accommodating and working to make sure that their needs are met. I personally have been involved in situations with, you know, special forces folks who needed special accommodations to make sure that we could allow them to continue their program. So it is a very critical and important and serious commitment we make to those folks to make sure they can move forward.
Thank you. Well, this has been very interesting, and members, Johnson has invited, tried to get the committee to come down, and it was during the election time, and it was kind of tough, but, you know, maybe you can come back. We're going to start having night meetings next week, I believe, because of in-depth people.
I got some technology for you.
Yes, and maybe what we can even see is you could come back and give us a little example of an actual class going on, because it's very interesting, and I'd love to ask you,
but I don't have time. What you think of the governor's proposal to have Minsky offer 25% of the classes online within the next 5 years, but I can't. So with that, I'm adjourned. And we'll invite you.